Moral imagination examined. That was a phrase that I learned out at Bethlehem College, and when I was out there, I'm learning to appreciate it in quite a number of ways. We are going to examine it, and I'm going to read from 2 Samuel and also in John. And eventually, I want to compare these two stories probably halfway through the message. And as you remember, the story that I used originally about David and Bathsheba, and he had an affair with a married woman, Bathsheba was at the time, and he took his took her husband and put him out in the front and got killed. And to cover up, he tried to cover up his affair. Bathsheba became pregnant, and David had to pay the price, or his son that died paid the price in my eyes. And this is a response in which David are looking at it. And then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." Nathan replied, "The Lord has taken away your sin, but you are not going to die. But because by doing this you have shown utter contempt for the Lord, or Yahweh, the God of Israel, the son born to you will die." And then I want to read the story in John about the adulterous woman. And this reading is not necessarily in every text or in every, in the beginning it says the early manuscripts, this story was not in there, but it was, parts of it was. So it's a story that was, didn't research it, but it was added or put in somewhere along the way, early. "At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. And the teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, 'Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. And in the law of Moses, commands us to stone such women. Now what do you say?' They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis of accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he'd straighten up and say to them, 'Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her.' And again he would stoop down and write on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, 'Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?' 'No one, sir,' she said. 'Then neither do I condemn you.' And Jesus declared, 'Go now and leave your life of sin.'" Why was the woman the only one named?
Condemned.
Oh, condemned?
Condemned.
Well, you're getting ahead of the message.
Okay, go for it.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. I guess we could go right to that, but then you wouldn't have an understanding of what moral imagination means. In a small town in North Central America, in North Central Pennsylvania, specifically, there's a church. It's a typical church in many ways. It's a white church with a steeple. It has long glass stained windows on each side, windows that tell a story, a Christian story. It's typical of a country church. It's beautiful from top to bottom and side to side. The people that attend are a well-diverse group of small people. No one particularly thinks the same. And this small church came together one day around the idea that it could provide a meal to anyone who came through the door of the dining room of this church. They called it the Fourth Sunday Supper. And this name of this church is Canoe Camp Church of Christ. We are an example of moral imagination. Another example is, during the, there was a man in Chicago who lived a normal life, didn't know where New Orleans was. He didn't concern himself with much other than what his own needs and family were. But for some reason, when Katrina came through New Orleans, he got the urge and the prompting to go rent a truck, load it up with clothing and whatever, and take it down and give it to the victims of the flood. He was acting out in his what the definition is as moral imagination. The definition of moral imagination comes from a time period around 1800 when the French Revolution or the Enlightenment period began and was in full swing. And Edmund Burke, who was an Englishman, looked at the French and said that they were acting and coined the phrase moral imagination. Well, what was happening in the French Enlightenment period? A lot of, this is what he wrote about it, a short paragraph. All the decent draperies of life is to be rudely thrown off. All the superadded ideas furnished from the wardrobe of moral imagination, which the heart owns and the understanding ratifies, as necessary to cover the defects of our own naked, shivering nature, and to rise and to raise its to dignity in our estimation, are being exploded as ridicule, absurd, and antiquated fashion. Anybody who knows anything about the Enlightenment period understands, or at least what little I know about the Enlightenment period, I'll say it that way, was a time when there was a free flow of ideas. It was the beginning of the scientific era. It began to split from the church, and there was and we are still affected by it today. It was basically, the way I understand it, the throwing off of traditional ideas and beginning to think for yourself. The age of reasoning was beginning when you started to think. Many of your scientists began there. Galileo, I wrote some down here somewhere, began. Galileo, Kepler, Isaac Newton, all these at the beginning of the Enlightenment, was in the beginning of the Enlightenment period. So everybody began to think in a way that was kind of on their own. As far as philosophers, John Locke, Francis Bacon, Thomas Hobbes, Rene Descartes, and a whole list of more. Immanuel Kant called this idea, dare to know, have the courage to use your own reason. Another of Voltaire was coined it and said, chaos of clear ideas. I like that one. There was ideas exploding everywhere all around. Traditional ideas were going by the wayside, or at least they were running beside the Enlightenment period. We are affected by it today and still are. As far as I'm concerned, like next Sunday, I'm going to say, bring the idea up that Jesus was the beginning of the Enlightenment period. And I'm going to start there. And I'm going to, and it's, that's Pentecost Sunday, and that's where the message is going to start. But today I want to basically give an understanding and go from there. The way I see it, moral imagination is defined as a set of morals. It's a set of morals, and we all know what morals are, a group of things that we consider, we measure what is right and wrong, and we hold up. So moral imagination is looking outside of what you normally consider to be right and wrong and put yourself in someone else's position and act in a moral way, or an extension of your own life. acting in a way that you consider to be moral. So as you see, it opens it up quite a ways. So what is considered to be normal mores now become in question. They're more flexible, they're more fluid. Science becomes on the field. They begin to prove a lot of scientific things. Deism comes on the scene, where the idea of God exists but doesn't have a hand directly within human life and everyday happenings in the world. So there's a whole array of ideas that start. Jonathan Jones explained it a little bit further and said, to be a citizen is not to be an autonomous individual. He's referring to moral imagination. It is a status given by a born existence into a world of relations to others. So the idea is that moral imagination requires you or asks you to step out from your normal life and to be part of a relationship of something larger than yourself. That's one way of looking at it. It's really hard to define it because it takes on a broad perspective, and it's not, you can't say this is what moral imagination means. To be fully human is to embrace the duties and the obligations toward a purpose of security and endurance for, first and foremost, the family and the local community. So again, he's referring to moral imagination as something outside of your normal life, what you consider to be your own concerns, your own way of thinking. Looking beyond that and trying to understand. Success is measured by the development of the character, not the fleeting emotions of status. It's more a group idea than it's a singular idea. But also, he was concerned about, in this whole process of the Enlightenment period and moral imagination, that we were losing some of what he calls sacramentally meaning of life. And what he meant by that, meaning that humans are connected with a sacramental order of creation. Somehow, and a configuration of the mind into the communication with the divine and beyond the rational. In this whole process of enlightenment, there seems to be an idea that we are moving away from God and not connecting with the spiritual realm. And he was concerned that in the whole process of moral imagination and the Enlightenment period, which I think we're still in as far as I would see it, we're still expanding quite rapidly. I'm not really sure when the Enlightenment period officially ended, if it ever did. I don't think it ever did. So it still continues today. So in this whole process, he was concerned that we would lose our tether to a spiritual idea and a divine, that science would somehow would try to explain everything away and there would be no divine left. You can somewhat see that around us today, that we are kind of losing our tether to the divine, to somewhat. We are, this is still playing out today. A lot of it's still playing out today. It's still relevant today. And the writer of the Frank Thomas is going to apply it in a couple messages. I'm going to use it. And moral imagination today. And mostly he went around civil rights and equality. Eventually I'm going to get there, but not today. So the idea is acting beyond oneself in a way that is different than what you think. So the question I want to ask in these two passages that I read was, Yahweh, the God of Israel, acting in a moral and imaginative way. First of all, the law required David to be stoned because he had an affair. He was married and he had an affair to a married woman. The Mosaic law flatly, plainly says they must be stoned. Both the man and the woman, yes. So, right off the bat, you see that Yahweh, the God of Israel, is changing something. He says that David is not going to die from his sins or from committing this adulterous affair, But he's going to move it over onto the son, and the son is going to die. The adulterous child, or the child that was conceived out of wedlock, is going to die. So do you see that as morally correct? Morally imaginative? Where is the responsibility? I'll say something that's a little more spurring. What responsibility does Bathsheba have? Why was she taking a bath in an open roof of a house, on top of her house, so that the king could gaze down upon her? What responsibility did David have for being lustful to start off with?
It is the responsibility of each individual to follow their moral compass. If it goes off kilter, it's their fault. It's not her fault for tempting him.
Not her fault for tempting him.
Well, you look at the way the Middle East is. If a woman isn't covered from head to foot with this huge thing, they're considered to be tempting to men.
That's true.
That's not true. It's man's fault for not being able to be in control of himself. I'm sorry.
I agree.
I see Bathsheba as tempting the man. Women can tempt men too.
Yeah,
she was just taking a bath. I didn't know she was out to tempting. She was just taking a bath.
On the top of a roof in the open sky where she obviously knew the king could look at her. Well, where do you take a bath at? Well, do you take a bath outside under the open and undress it out in the open sky?
Inside, but maybe they didn't have an inside
right.
there.
They didn't have indoor plumbing.
Right. I'm not sure where the actual bathing would have taken place at that time, but I don't remember seeing anything that said it was unusual. But I'll have to research that. That's really a good question.
I can't answer that. Yeah, I don't know if it was unusual for her to be taking a bath outside or not. That maybe, but it says it's on the top of a roof where it was uncovered and she was in the wide open, where King David could look down and see her. And
she did it to tempt him or not. He is as much or more at fault for acting on it.
Okay, I'm not disagreeing with that. But I'm only saying, yes.
I look at it like this. He stood there and saw a bittersweet fruit. And he was tempted to take a bite out of that fruit so that he could get a chill out of it. And that's just the way it is. They're both adults. They're both tempting each other. They're equally as at fault.
The only problem with that argument is they didn't have equal rights. So she had to be submissive to the man. She, because the story says that she sent, David sent somebody down there to tell her to come up to him.
She didn't have to respond, did she?
Well,
she was the king.
I think she had to respond. I would argue she would have to respond. What recourse would she have had to say no to the king? Huh? She's more at fault? Oh, he's more at fault.
Because he has to answer to the king, no matter what
he wants. He initiated it.
As Shelley said, he was a dirty old man.
But then you come down to two, the sins of the fathers or mothers visited on the child. That is not forgiveness in any way, shape, or form, and it's not morally right.
When we get to Jesus, that's what we're going to go for.
Maybe the Lord was tempting him to see if he was fit to be king.
And that's a good one.
He obviously was. He was a man after Yahweh's own heart. That's what it says, after the Lord's own heart.
In that day.
In that day?
That opens an interesting door.
In that day. You have to understand it in the perspective of that time, for sure. And he was king. And he had numerous, 8 wives, concubine of who knows how many, 19 sons and 1 daughter. This is what I researched on David. So he had a choice of many, many women, but he wanted that one.
In other words, a man couldn't sin then as long as he didn't take one he isn't supposed to.
Well, Bathsheba was married. That's where the complication came in, I think.
He wasn't married?
He was married, but the man at the time could have multiple wives. That's the next idea that I'm going to throw into this mix. It seems that throughout the Bible, illustrious affairs and people outside of Israel had a heavy influence into the lineage of Messiah, of Jesus. If you research it, the Moabites, the various groups outside of the Israelites. And here I would inject an idea for food for thought. And Colleen and I were talking about coming over. Was Jesus actually a Jew or an Israelite? Was Jesus actually a Jewish Israelite? Or was he a mixture of a whole bunch of multi-race individual? Which would represent more the character of a Messiah of the world. Right. I personally don't think that Jesus was a Jew. Not 100% sanctioned Jew. He was raised by the Jewish people, or so said Jewish people. But even where he came from, Bethlehem or Judea, or up where he was from, what did they say? Nothing good could come out of that? I mean, he wasn't raised in a totally high-level Jewish faith. So somehow Yahweh, the God of Israel, breaks all his own laws and gets to have the Messiah. Somehow it gets up to that. The firstborn, which the Jewish faith explicitly and which we still hold today, gets the inheritance. But I'll tell you right from the very beginning of the Bible, that didn't happen. It was the second son who got the inheritance the whole way through. And here is a clear case in which David should have been stoned by the Mosaic Law. No questions about it. But yet he moves it ahead and punishes the child and takes the life of the child. Then they go and get married. And then they have another son who is Solomon. And Solomon was promiscuous as, I'll get out. I'll take one at a time. Dan.
I don't think that God really wanted people behaving the way they did in the start there, so it probably shouldn't have even been in the Bible that they were okay to do it, because I wouldn't think he would have.
Well, you're saying these stories shouldn't be in the Bible, they should be...
Well, the people who put them in there thought the wrong way. They thought stuff was okay, but I wouldn't think God would have wanted it that way.
I think the Old and the New give us a comparison and help us to understand what Jesus did. That's what I
say. One tiny thing about that. Men did it. Men wrote it. Women had very little to say about it.
Hebrews is thought to be written by a woman. Oh. And I love that book. Well, that's a very important book as far as I'm concerned. I think the Bible pivots on Hebrews myself. On the explanation there, it explains the difference between the Old and the New Testament and the value of the New versus the Old. And I think that's where it pivots on myself. And that was thought to be written by a woman, by a lot of scholars. But I understand what you're saying, that women don't seem to have a voice in here. So getting back to Bathsheba, did she actually have a choice in the matter? She probably didn't.
He had the bigger choice.
Yes. So now we'll go to what Jesus did to the adulterous woman. And in my understanding, Jesus operated in the realm of moral imagination, for sure. First of all, he starts off, he doesn't take the men's side, he takes the woman's side. He defends the undefendable, the woman who had no rights. So he starts off by defending her and standing on her side and works from that point. And he works in forgiveness, is how I see it. What did it, yes?
What is that? At that point there, then, didn't Jesus put himself in a position to where he could have been stoned?
By sticking up for her?
Yes. By accepting her sin, and that then he was going against the creed, well, the belief of that particular church at that time in their laws, but didn't he put himself in a position to be stoned?
Well, I think Jesus put himself in a position right from age 12 on. I mean, biblically, Jesus was never aligned with the way I see it, 100% with the Jewish law, ever.
Did men get stoned?
Only, I think, the one I know about is when a married man and a married woman gets, they have an affair, yes, they both get stoned. And there are other sins that men get stoned for. But I can't think of, do you remember any offhand? There is some, but I can't. I read some, most of the law. I think like sexual acts that they weren't supposed to have. A lot of it had to do with sexual acts that you weren't supposed to have, like with your mother or your sister or, you know, things like that. And of course, GBLT people were stoned. So yes, there was other people getting stoned. Mostly it was women. I say that, but women seem to be the one who caught the blunt end of things a lot of times. That's
to the lack of power.
They didn't have a voice, that's for sure.
So stone her, because what's she going to do about it?
Well, still happens today. I think the whole idea of equal rights and equality is a way of stoning the underprivileged to some extent. We just changed the stones to something different in a lot of different ways. So what Jesus wrote on the ground is up for debate, you know, because no one really knows. My opinion is that these men were getting rid of evidence. They were the ones who committed the adultery with her. And it went on for several generations because it started with the old and went down to the young. The old gave up first and threw the stone down and walked away. Because I think Jesus was saying, remember this time, remember that time, remember this, remember that. And they realized that Jesus knew. And I think the reason that they were so anxious to stone her was because you got evidence out of the way. And so Jesus stopped it. So I also think that Jesus operated in the realm of forgiveness, so that when the men let the stones down on the ground, that represents that they accepted a type of forgiveness within themselves. They realized and accepted and put the stone down, and it was no longer violence that was going to solve the issue, but it was forgiveness. So I think Jesus operated in the realm of forgiveness and stood up for the woman. And in the end, Jesus says, I don't condemn you either. No one condemns you, so why should I?
If you look at it in a darker way, which at times I have, in reading it, is that the men didn't want to be questioned as to whether, you know, if they threw a stone, okay, you've never committed a sin, how about, type
right.
thing.
Right.
They didn't want to be questioned on it.
Right.
They didn't want to have their dirty linen put forth.
Right. These ideas are still in play today. We're not exempt from these ideas. And as much as we think we are enlightened, we're not. There are some who are and some who are not. And I think that's kind of what, getting back to Edmund Burke, who was looking at the Enlightenment period as saying, okay, here's a group of people that are enlightened and here's a group of people who are not. And I think that still runs up through today. We have traditionalists and we have those who think outside of the box and continue on. So I'm going to conclude. Anybody have anything else to say? I think that, as I said, Hebrews is, for me, written by a woman who, this text gives a lot of latitude in which we can say the old should be done away with and we should accept the new. If you never read Hebrews or the whole way through, I encourage you to read it from beginning to the end, the whole way through. It definitely gives for a new agreement. There's a new agreement, a new idea on the field, and it's certainly an expansion, a moral imagination out of the Old Testament, for sure. Or traditional hardline moral values. We still play out today. One of the things is abortion. Some people want to say none. Some want to say, okay, in case of rape and incest, people still want to have access, but may not agree with it at all, but still allow woman access. This is how it's playing out today in a lot of different ways. Same way with the GBLT community, in the same way. It's an issue that is played out along a scale of moral imagination. Equal rights is another one that's still playing out today. And well, who knows where it goes. And anybody want to make a comment?
Power.
What?
Power.
Power. Again, I'll go back to my original statement several messages ago, speaking truth to power.
If you're sitting on top of the power structure, it doesn't make any difference who wrote the laws.
Right.
Or how they're written.
Right.
Because you can turn them in your favor.
Yeah.
And we are watching it happen.
Yeah. And that's where we are today. And in the case of these men in front of Jesus, they thought they were speaking truth to power. They were power. They thought they were power, for sure. This is the interaction of all this happening today. If you watch it on the news, it's really fascinating. I try not to get too depressed about it, but some days it gets, well, I just have to turn the knob off because it gets to be too much. Go ahead.
This is Dad for me, and we would love that you do this.
Speak up, please.
One of the things that you could be put to death for was picking up sticks on the Sabbath.
Yes. Too many steps. If you walk too many steps. Joe Lieberman,
You were doing work.
Too much work, yes.
Yeah, because you could walk so many steps, like Lieberman walking to the synagogue.
Yes. Right.
Even if the steps were right.
They have the number of steps that you can walk on the Sabbath. They have it figured out. And Joe Lieberman used to, this is the story that was told, and I believe it to be true, that he would, like midnight, Sabbath is over on Saturday sunset. So they would have a time. So he would start walking down the street, and he would know how many steps he had left over, and the limousine would be riding beside him. And when the clock ticked and he ran out of the steps, he would jump into the limousine and he would go. Yeah, that's, see, all of this, you know, we think it is silly, but it's still playing out today. And it's still on the scene today, on full force. I don't really have any other closing comment other than that we have to learn to drop our stones and accept forgiveness and move on with our lives. And I do think this church, as the Fourth Sunday Supper, is a really good example of moral imagination. And I think we are truly blessed by being able to reach out in a way. And whoever came up with the idea, I'm not really sure who came up with it, this was going on before me, truly had a very brilliant idea. All I can remember is, I think, Carol, you were telling me that after the first time you did that, everybody went outside and stood, and they felt the Spirit of God move amongst them, and they knew that they did the right thing and that they needed to keep doing it. And I think that is a moral imagination. And I will close with amen.
Our hearts and minds join together now